history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Radio Free Hillsdale's first edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary men and women who have done some pretty extraordinary things. You never know unless you take the time to talk to them and listen to some of their stories. We want to honor our veterans for their service to our country. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're educated, we're entertained, and quite often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. You'll find over 400 episodes archived at hometownheroesradio.com, but with WRFH bringing you the program for the first time here in Hillsdale, I wanted you to hear from someone close by. If you were to head northwest to Ionia, Michigan, you'd have to watch out for the 91-year-old in the Porsche Boxster. Lou Guernsey lives a pretty adventurous life, but he never expected that adventure to include time as a prisoner of war when he ended up in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II.
I was working in a defense plant down in Detroit in a heat treat department. I was drafted and went to the Army, and they put me in the Air Force. But I used to build airplanes when I was a kid and fly them, and I understood the rudiments of flying, and I guess maybe that's why.
Well, of all the guys I've talked to who enlisted in the Army Air Corps of their own volition, they wanted to be pilots for the most part. You, having been drafted, were you open to any assignment they had for you?
No. I told everybody that I'd seen I wanted to be a gunner.
Why was that?
I don't know. I just wanted to be a gunner. Maybe I've seen too many movies on gunners or stuff, coming in on a wing and a prayer, you know, and things like that. I don't know, but that's what I wanted to do. And I made that dream come true.
Yeah, what was that like? You said you wanted to do that from the get-go. It kind of sounds like you had a natural inclination and ability there. Were there some tough moments along the way to figure that out and actually get assigned?
No. After we went through gunnery school, in fact, some of the guys weren't too good at shots at the gunnery school, so I would shoot for them so they could get their scores up. I was a natural gunner, I guess. After we got in our airplane and we started flying over the Gulf of Mexico, they'd have gunnery practice down there. They would throw out ammunition boxes, and I could shoot those boxes all apart as I was falling with my tail guns. My crew loved that. They thought they were completely safe in back because I could shoot like that.
Well, I guess so, and I want to ask you about something you said there. You talked about other gunners having you shoot for them to get their scores up. How'd you pull that off? You got up in the air, and they were supposed to be at the gun, and you took over, or what are you saying there?
Yes, I did that with shotguns, too.
I don't think anyone's ever told me a story.
I used to shoot every chance I got.
Uh-huh.
Down in the gunnery school, they had an arcade game that you could shoot machine guns at airplanes flying across the ceiling of this thing. It was a big concave ceiling, and I used to lay in that thing by the hour and play with it. I loved it. You know, I like flying.
I asked you about getting into the Army Air Corps, but you mentioned being married. The story here starts before you went overseas for World War II. Now you had this lovely lady in your life. When did you meet Anne, and when did you know that she was going to be your wife someday?
Well, I come home on furlough, and my stepmother had moved. And so I come up to the house, and I was in there changing my shirt. I remember I'd had my shirt on 3 or 4 days, and I was changing it. My sister said, Lou, she says, there's Anna Lee out there. Should I call her in? And I figured a girl about 12 or 10 or 12 years old was coming in. And I said, yes. And in come Anna Lee. And she was a little doll. But she was 16 at the time. She had on a big red apron, and I'll never forget that. And her face got red, and she went right back outside, and I went right out after her. And we started dating while I was on this furlough, and I knew the third time that I went out with her I was going to marry her. I didn't tell her that because I didn't want to scare her off. She was still going to school. And, of course, I was 18 at the time, you know, or 19, but I knew it. I had to have her for a wife. She's something.
You said you knew she was going to be your wife, but the catch there was you would have to survive a war and survive being a prisoner of war to make it back to marry her. But when you went overseas, you took something to remind you of her, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I had a picture in a little leather pad that I used to put in my jacket all the time when I flew. And I had that on. I still got that picture here. It was on me when I got shot down.
Before we get to your 32nd and final mission with the 394th Bomb Group, the 586th Bomb Squadron, I want to talk about your first taste of this plane that has been much maligned in history. Now, when most people think of bombers in World War II, they automatically go to B-17s, B-24s, and B-29s. But you flew another bomber, the B-26 Marauder, which some people said was a murderer, not a marauder. They called it the Flying Coffin. All kinds of awful names for it. One a day in Tampa Bay as you trained down there at MacDill Field in Florida. Was it really as bad as all those nicknames suggest?
Well, it was. Due to the fact it was a hot rod.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's somebody like flying. I'll say you was driving a Model A Ford, and then all of a sudden somebody put you in a hot rod and told you to go out in the street, and the first thing you're going to do is wreck it because you don't know how to handle it.
All right.
After the people got to learn how to fly the things, they were a great, great airplane. In fact, they had the lowest loss ratio due to enemy action of any airplane in the Air Force. Now, that's quite a pipeful, but that's what happened, really.
Mm-hmm. So you came to appreciate this plane, the B-26.
It was the speed. We were fast. The Germans didn't jump it too much with their aircraft because it was fast. We had 12 machine guns on that thing, and the Germans treated us pretty much, I think, with respect. In fact, I flew 32 missions. And I only shot at one German airplane, and that was a rocket plane going straight up. And it was through frustration that I shot at him because I used to sit there and they'd shoot at us with anti-aircraft. There was nothing I could do but sit there and take it, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
But when German aircraft come in and started shooting at you, you knew somebody was going down. You knew that. The Germans, they were good fighters. Don't underestimate those guys. They were good.
No doubt about it. And their technology at that point was certainly superior. You referenced a rocket plane. I'm guessing you meant the ME-262, the first jet fighter,
yeah.
Right?
That's what it was, yeah. And if Hitler hadn't invaded Russia, we'd still been fighting that war over there, I think.
Well, thank God.
It was terrible.
Now, I want to ask you about some of your missions, but just out of curiosity, the B-26, give us a picture of what that crew was like, how many guys were on the crew, and were you jealous that you didn't get to be a nose gunner on that plane? Because the nose gunner had a pretty great view of everything in that see-through plexiglass nose of that plane.
No, I wanted to be a tail gunner. I went through the war seeing where I'd been instead of where I was going, because I rode backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a good view of everything in back. And if I could watch the bombs go down, I could see what they hit. And it was interesting back there. I was all by myself. There was a six-man crew on a B-26.
Mm-hmm.
There was the first guy, like you said, was a bombardier. Then there was a pilot and a co-pilot, a top turret gunner. He was the engineer. Then there was a radio man, and he was a waist gunner. And then there was myself. I was the armor. I was a tail gunner. And I would check the bombs after they were loaded, make sure they were fused right, and check the guns on the airplane. That was my job, plus being a tail gunner.
Do you remember what your first mission was like? And do you remember feeling a little anxiety going into it?
But the first mission was a great adventure. I thought, man, this is great. You know, I really loved it. We went on a milk run. A milk run is where there's no anti-aircraft. We were bombing a warehouse, and we didn't drop bombs. We come back because of the clouds. So the second mission was the same thing, but we dropped bombs that time. Then on my third mission, it was over Metz, France, and we went in 6,000 feet. And I thought, man, this is great, you know. Look at that. There was 20 millimeters coming up from the Germans, and I was looking at them, you know, and I didn't think much of them. Then on the fourth mission, the airplane next to us exploded, and I said, I don't like this anymore. You know? And then from then on, when I seen heavy air, any aircraft, it was terrifying to sit there, you know, and couldn't do nothing, just scared. Mm. I didn't say nothing to nobody, but I'll tell you, I was plenty scared back there. If anybody says they were flying in an airplane and they were shooting at that any aircraft, you could hear it, you could smell it, and you knew what it was bad.
When those moments came, when you felt that fear come on, did you find any way to deal with it and to end up focusing again? I mean, did you sneak a peek at Ann's picture inside your coat? Were you a praying man? How did you get through those moments?
Oh, yeah, I used to pray back there. I wasn't saved at that time. I am now. We'd sit back there, and you couldn't smoke because if you lit up a cigarette, you got a leak in the gas tank or something, you know, and there was gas fumes in there, the whole plane would explode.
Mm-hmm.
So you just sat back there and hope that you got through it all right. Sometimes you'd look ahead of the airplane, you'd see flak up there. The Germans put what they'd call a wall of flak up, and you had to fly through it.
Yeah, you can't try to avoid it because you're in
you're
formation.
You're on a bomb
right?
run and everything, and you have to fly straight and level for 3 or 4 minutes while they go from the IP to the dropping, you know, where they drop them. And it was terrifying. The Germans they couldn't understand. They could not turn back an American flight airplanes. The guys would fly through the stuff. They knew somebody was going to get hurt, but they still did it.
I can't imagine being in your shoes in a situation like that, knowing what's coming and just bracing for impact. I'm curious, during this time, were you able to form a pretty good bond with the members of your crew and actually keep that crew together for most of these missions?
Yes. Well, we trained down in Shreveport, Louisiana, and we had a good camaraderie. In fact, the top turret man, he was in the same prison camp with me. He was my best man when I got married. Mm. Then I went over to Wisconsin and seen the other gunner, Reuben Harchi. He was the radio man. But I'm the last man of the crew that's alive right now. When we got shot down, there were 6 of us in the airplane, and 3 were killed and 3 of us got out.
And your families didn't know whether or not you'd been killed. We're going to get to all of that, but it's time for our first break. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos related to Lou Guernsey's story. And we'll be right back with a little bit of his musical talent after this.